On the programme, from Cork, art from Berlin at the Crawford, and 21 years of commitment, the dance goes on at Cork City Ballet. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. Cork City is never less than lively when it comes to music, poetry, theatre, film or the visual arts. A new independent film festival, Indie Cork, is due to start there in October. The Crawford Gallery continues its engagement with contemporary European art and artists, and Cork City Ballet marks its 21st year. First to the Crawford. False Optimism is the title of an exhibition running there featuring the work of 15 artists based in Berlin, four of them Irish. The exhibition has been organised in conjunction with the Auto Center Gallery in Berlin and reflects something of the openness and diversity of the art scene in the German capital.
Hello, good to meet you.
Yeah. We visited the Crawford, where its director, Peter Murray, showed us around just before the opening.
Let's go inside.
Brilliant.
Yeah, great.
The curators were busy putting last-minute touches to the show.
Mike Sherlock from the Auto Centre. And so Mike is one of the co-curators.
Yeah, we have changes there.
Fantastic change. Very good.
Mm. Fresh, maybe, yeah,
fresh
really
eye.
I like it, yeah.
The screw goes into the column only.
The first piece we look at is the work of the artist Timur C. Quinn.
This work, it's very evident and almost like an advertising banner, but the face depicted of this very beautiful model is a face that's quite unlike anything you would see in reality, because he's made the face utterly symmetrical. It doesn't contain any of the actual variations in symmetry that a human face. So although it's astonishingly lifelike, it's also astonishingly not lifelike. And then it's presented, I think, with almost a Tibetan feel, with these prayer flags hanging from it. So it's a very elegiac piece, and possibly there's a resonance here because Timur's father is from Mongolia, and his mother, he grew up in Arizona. He studied in the United States, so he's this very interesting mix, you know, an artist of such mixed ancestry, living and working in Berlin, but bringing to that work then some, I think, you know, extraordinary consciousness of East and West mixed. So that's Timur's work. Very, very, in a way, not understated, but very carefully stated, very precise in the way he's positioned it.
It seems to be a kind of photograph on board, as it were, and really, really tall. I mean, it's taller than me, but
yeah, it's a billboard scale image. You know, the face from the chin to the forehead is as tall as I am, or taller. So these are very large images and very arresting visually, halfway between the world of fine art and the world of advertising and marketing. And in that way that they're presented, there's actually this very nice resonance, too, between the fully commercial retail development across the road. You've got Boots, you've got Topshop, you know, you've got all those new shops around. And this part of Cork has really become quite heavily, redeveloped, and there's a lot of retail shops, fashion shops, and so on around. And so this work is very good because it talks to not just people coming into the gallery, but it talks to the environment around the gallery.
I mean, it could be a cover for a kind of a gloss magazine, in a sense.
But
when you look closely, there's something unreal and slightly disturbing in it. And, of course, then the billboard is split down the middle. So the face is divided in two, right down the centre of the nose, down the centre of the lips. Yeah. The eyes are divided. So it's ultimately somehow it is disturbing. And, as you say, what looks like a very real and idealised human face then almost becomes doll-like and goes into another realm.
There's a strange relationship then, because of the fact that it's a group show. You've got this interesting relationship and this conversation, I would call it, between works by different artists. And directly opposite that piece by Timur, you walk into this room, and this room is measures about 5 meters by 5 meters. It's a big room, and it's entirely covered in post-its, entirely covered in a geometric pattern of post-its, those small yellow square labels that are so ubiquitous, that are found in every office home, stuck in the dashboard of people's cars. And here, thousands of them have been employed in this extraordinary creation that now, when, as it's completed, floor, ceiling, all the walls, the bench covered in post-its in the centre, takes on this
floor, it's
everything.
Like being inside a daffodil or a primrose. It's yellow.
I was thinking almost like a sort of, it's always a beehive effect.
A bee inside a daffodil.
Yes, and that geometric pattern that they've adopted, you know, has some echo of that. But it's an extraordinary expression of the power of art to be very simply transformative. That's something that's so inexpensive and everyday, these low-tack little notelets can be employed so simply to create an environment that is like almost a work of alchemy. It's transformed this room.
It is. It's terrific. And then they're put on a different angle, so you actually get a different textured effect. Mm-hmm. And so it almost becomes sculptural as well in places.
The way the light catches them is the more you look, the more you become fascinated. And it's so delicate. It's so delicate.
It's terrific.
If you touch it, it falls like leaves from autumn trees.
I dare to
so
touch.
So we better...
I also love the fact that through this opening opposite us, you're looking at another work of art, which maybe, again, inadvertently echoes the colour here, because you've got this a cowboy on a horse, and there's in a pool of kind of green and yellow water, what looks like anyway in the distance, and flashes of yellow. It's a wonderful... it's a great view of that piece through here.
That's a painting by Titania Dahl. She's a painter. She has a magnificent studio in the Ufer studio complex in Berlin, which is an old factory that's been renovated and forms a home now for dance studios and painters. And it's very typical of Berlin in the sense that it's a former industrial building that's now been given over to the arts and as a center for artistic creativity. And because of the existence of so many of those former industrial buildings that have been transformed in that way, Berlin has become a great center for artists, not only from Berlin, from all over Germany, but from all over the world. And Titania, who is German, but she's not from Berlin originally, has made a magnificent, studio. She's established a wonderful studio. She paints on a very large scale, absolutely ambitious, on a sort of opera house scale. So there's a painting by her upstairs, and it is must be 4 meters by 4 meters. And so to see that confidence of scale and the confidence of handling of paint, where she just look at the way she works with the paint, she allows it to do anything and everything that it wants to do, and yet she still holds to that figuration of that image that is, in a certain way, iconic. Hate to use that word. Apologies for that.
But it can be a true word.
The other traditional painter, because this exhibition includes works in non-traditional media, but it also has works by Eberhard Havakost, such as this, the drone painting, a large grey painting that has a figurative image of a drone. Rather sinister, very quiet, very low-key, large scale. Eberhard Havakost is one of a generation of East German artists who came to prominence, perhaps being trained in a more traditional way as they were in East Germany, and then after the fall of the Berlin Wall and reunification, 1989 onwards, those East German painters, emerged as a very strong, very convincing artistic force within Germany itself. And he's a cautious... He's genuinely not an optimistic painter. And perhaps I think it's from this work and others by Eberhard Havakost that the title of the exhibition, False Optimism, he loved that title. And I think it fits his work because he's from Dresden. And he'd be one of the major painters to have emerged in Dresden and was given a retrospective at the museum there not too long ago. But there is that sense of reserve, of not embracing fully the consumer capitalist message of Western society. You know, he's much more cautious and very, very solid, very interesting painter, very interesting because he's got great depth to his work. There's great depth of thinking to his work. To again use an overused word, there's a profundity in it, and in those two works just to the right. So like so many other of the works in this exhibition, these have come directly from the artist's studio, and I've saw those works in his studio, and his studio is on the bank of a canal in Berlin, and it used to actually be on the line of the Berlin Wall. So on the studio complex within which he works, there used to be sentries and barbed wire and all of that. It actually ran along the spine of the wall. So the building itself within which he works has all of that history. And it's a history that is actually vanishing now to a substantial degree in Berlin, as the city has been so much rebuilt. The reality for artists in Berlin is that the rents are still relatively low. Studio space is still relatively easily available, far more so than, say, in Paris or London or other cities. And partly that's because of the promised boom in property prices that people thought would emerge after reunification never really arrived. There was a huge amount of money invested in the renovation of old industrial buildings, apartments, and so on, bringing them up to a standard. And all of that work has actually reaped benefits, which have been, the benefits have been availed by artists who are able to live and work there far more, I think, easily than they are in any other European city at the moment. So it would be easy to predict the future of Berlin as it continues to develop and grow, that the and as economics of the city, you know, become ever more, embedded, that. The rents will rise, and artists will be forced to out into lower cost areas. But at the moment, and in this past decade, it's attracted a good number of Irish artists, but also artists from all over the world. There are four Irish artists in the exhibition.
Before that, we talk about some of their work, yes. Peter. I know there's no common theme in the work here that would identify it, if you like, as Berlin art.
Yes.
But for you, as somebody who has visited Berlin, seen many of the galleries, met the artists there, is there any energy? Is there something that actually pulls the artists together and that makes it in some way particular or identifiable or Berlin? Mm.
Some themes have emerged, and those are themes which are not they were never predetermined. I think glass, perspex, transparency, translucency has been one of the themes, in a sense that artists are looking at the world as if, you know, they're looking at it through glass, or employing the qualities of reflection or slight transparency or color. So Peggy Frank's large work in the 18th century room is an enormous work, leaning at a slight angle, moving, just traversing at an angle the 18th century room, reflecting the portraits of 18th century Cork personages, but also allowing those portraits to be seen through the work. So it's a reflection, and also then there's that transparent quality. Dennis McNulty, in his talk to the students of the Crawford College of Art this morning here in the gallery, discussed the way in which glass kind of acts in a cinematic way. For him, it forms almost an edit between the noise of the street, which you cannot hear, but you can see what's happening in the street outside through that window, cars passing, people going in and out. So the glass has a sort of almost cinematic editing quality. And this quality, I think, also is a very important part of Kitty Krause's installation on the second floor, where she has, with the simplest of materials again, just glass and electric light bulbs, created this amazing installation where light radiates out from these simple cubes made of mirrored glass in a pattern which is extraordinary and very difficult to describe, but it is almost like a science fiction city seen at night. But like Ilgin's work, it seems to also have this resonance within the history of 20th century art, minimalist movement, arte povera, taking a simple material like a light bulb, and then four squares of glass, and then just employing it with such finesse to create this transformative quality.
The Irish artists then who are represented here, you know, would they have talked to you at all about their work having been influenced by being in Berlin, by the presence of the city around them?
Absolutely, because one of the distinctions that's occurred in the exhibition in terms of looking at the work is, I think, a very profound sense within which the Irish artists, Una Quigley, Kieran Walsh, Dennis McNulty and Declan Clark, is a sense in which they're responding to the city more than perhaps artists from the Netherlands, from Belgium, from Norway, who are also included in the show, artists from other parts of Europe or the United States who settled in Berlin. There does seem to be, to my mind, a sense in which the Irish artists are more conscious of the history, and they're conscious of the sense of the events that took place in the 20th century. You see this in Declan Clark's videos, where one of the works that we'll see, it's a film, some of which was filmed in Eisenstattenhut, a former industrial town of East Germany. And it's a work filmed in black and white, and it has all the resonance of the Cold War feeling about it. And he's also explored the history of Berlin itself in the documentary, not a documentary, quasi-documentary, on Rosa Luxemburg, a meditation, if you like, on Rosa Luxemburg.
Upstairs, there's Una Quigley's film Gifted Water, filmed at Teufels Mountain, or the Devil's Mountain, made from the debris of the bombed city of Berlin.
My film is called Gifted Water, and the script evolved from a short story that I wrote when I arrived in Berlin. And with some funding that I got from the Arts Council, I started to make the piece based on a collaboration with a really interesting dancer that I met there called Sheena McGrandles. And we kind of improvised the piece in various sites in Berlin over a couple of months. And at the same time that I was filming with Sheena, I composed the music with Lawrence. So some of the music was written before the piece was finished, and Sheena worked with the music, and some of the music was written after the edit, according to Sheena's movements. A kind of underlying concept is, it's a piece really about the unfixed nature of identity, because she shifts from, I was doing a lot of research into identity disorders, I'm interested in that kind of thing, and she shifts from child to animal to, at the end, she becomes male at the end. So it's quite absurd, but at the same time, it was based on research of people who do actually have disorders like that. So it's quite an absurd piece of work. It has an absurd ontology, but I was trying to make the body perform the ideas, working with Sheena to make her body perform the ideas rather than giving a conceptual direction about what this piece should be. One site that was really central to the piece, it's called Teufelsberg, and it's in the Grunewald in Berlin, and it was an old listening site for when the Americans were there. And it's a very striking, strange place, but you get an amazing view over Berlin. And we filmed up there. And we weren't supposed to. We had to kind of sneak in, and it was all improvised, all the filming. And she was climbing up the hill, and we had to film really, really quickly. And that became kind of central to the piece. So the sites that I found kind of responded to my short story, but then the sites took on their own meaning themselves. So it was a kind of piece that took on its own kind of meaning as I made it.
We also meet artist Stefan Becker-Schmitz and his partner and baby.
She's the main artwork here.
Of course.
But it's an optimistic one.
Yeah. And with Stefan and Peter, we view Kitty Krause's work Untitled.
In these two, the modern galleries here, we have an installation by the artist Kitty Krause, who has come over from Berlin to work here in the gallery, and she has created an installation in these two rooms The rooms are in darkness, but they're illuminated with these cubes of light that she's made from the simple materials of glass, mirrored glass and light bulbs. And the light bulbs are within these cubes of glass, but emerging from the corners are these rays of light that fall.
And they're placed on the floor as well, at floor level.
Exactly, so they illuminate the floor, the walls and the ceiling with these extraordinary patterns. It's an untitled work, and some of the works of art in this exhibition have come fresh from the artist's studio. Others have literally been created right here in the gallery, such as the poster room downstairs made by Stefan and Ilgin over the past week.
And this work here as well, made in situ. I mean, it's the transformative nature of it is amazing. Just the idea that these rooms can be made into... It's almost like a kind of modernist cathedral of light somehow with these geometric shapes. It's so beautiful.
It is. It's eloquent, simple, beautiful. And it references not only itself and the artist's work, you know, they're within the sequence of works that Kitty Krause has made, but also it references so subtly the history of modernism, of minimalist art, and indeed of arte povera, you know, where artists worked just using very simple, basic, essential materials.
Here also a landscape is coming. There's a horizon, and it's just a wall in one moment. In the next moment, it's so deep. You can fall into it, and that's something you can't explain in word in German or English. That's a moment, it's magic. I love it. I really love it.
Stefan collaborated with Ilgin Atom Choi on the post-its we saw earlier.
Okay, now we can see some young people looking at the Brennstoffzelle, the post or note installation, sticky note installation. And that's where it becomes quite international, because everywhere, all the people, the first thing is they do the same in Ireland or wherever they make, whoa, or crazy. That's almost the same reaction, I think, because they don't have the words to describe it, and that's what makes it interesting. When on the opening evenings I'm there and I'm looking, or when there is a walk around, I'm part of it. I don't think about that, how the reaction is. I'm interested in the room and the space and using the material and changing the context. I don't think about the people, just doing it. Be careful, only on socks. Because, we want that. We can make sure that other people can see it like that. Normally we destroy it in the end, like monks do, a mandala they destroy too. It's quite the same thing, because this is a torture, and we would say catharsis in Germany, but that's just a personal thing. That's not part of the artwork.
Stefan takes us to view another installation, this one by Peggy Frank in the Crawford's 18th century room.
We should go upstairs. There's a room with a big mirror made by a woman. Maybe you should see it. It's fantastic. Oh, we come inside, and in the first moment we don't see, really realize that there is something in the room, because it's a little bit transparent. You don't see it. And when you come into the room, suddenly, there is a big kind of mirror, looks a little bit like shades, and with this mirror effect, color is switching from yellow into red, and you can see this contemporary art, the floor and the old paintings, and all that comes together in one room. I think it's wonderful.
Mike Schirlo and Joep van Lieflandt, tell me about the gallery you started in Berlin in 2001.
Yeah, we started in Berlin 2001 in a club space, and we together make one room. It's 90 square meter, 2001, and there we were for 7 years. And then we go to another place. Yes.
And that was a former repair shop, so that's why we took the name Auto Center. We found like a, how do you say, like a card, like a like address card. So we thought that's a good name. But it also refers to auto, so you have to do a lot of stuff yourself. So that's
and it's a garage. It's a garage.
It's not a gallery. You have to explain it's not really, it's not a commercial gallery. Huh? Let's make that clear.
That's a working station.
It's a working station.
When you set it up in 2001, when the Auto Center was set up, what was the reason? What did you want to achieve with it?
It was an experiment. We didn't know what was exactly going to happen, but we thought, let's do it, let's try it, but on our merits. So we want to say, this is how we do it. So we didn't adapt another model, but we make our own model. That's from the beginning the most important thing, I would say.
Yes, and see what's happened with all the artists, all the friends of us, and see what's coming. And this art from the artist, yes.
We are both artists. We have our art practice. That is the most important thing to us. So how do we organize a space that's interesting for everybody, but can be managed from us without losing too many hours on the art?
Yeah, but in the first 7 years, we make only the shows for 3 days. Only we have the opening, and then we have Saturday and Sunday to visit it, and then was finished. So it took not so many time in the first time. Yes. After 7 years, we make shows for 2 weeks and 3 weekends.
In a bigger space.
In a bigger space. And then we have a little bit assistance, internship, and helping us.
But we keep it very, you can see it here. We do things very fast and efficient, I would say.
So and today is very hard, so okay, today we work on it. It's 1 day, but it's okay.
We do it. We fix it in 1 day. Like a car repairman.
It's not right. All the people do it.
No, it's my, for us, we fix it. Yeah, I don't mean it. We fix the situation. Yeah. I mean, for us, we also, at home, we fix
things. It's the practical application as well. It's the practicality of
it. It's a practicality. Yes. It's not possible for us to have a lot of time, and we don't have a lot of money, so things,
we have no money.
We have no money, so it's already from this kind of boundaries, we have to operate in a certain way.
The exhibition here at the Crawford, False Optimism, I know a great deal of the work came through the Auto Gallery.
This is one of the best German artists at the moment are exhibiting here. We have to say it. It is very important painters and the young emerging artists that are very well known at the moment and really in the beginning of probably a very big career.
Yeah, it's
really
level, yeah.
It can really say it's an extremely high level of German artist we have invited together with Peter for here in Quark. So that's really we have to say.
I suppose there's a perception of Berlin as a vibrant city for the visual arts, as a city where studio space is still relatively inexpensive and fairly freely available. And I know quite a few Irish artists have gone to spend time in Berlin for that very reason, because it's easier to afford studio space and a place to live and work than, for instance, it would be maybe in Dublin or Cork.
But it changed, just now it changed in Berlin. Now the rent is more expensive, but there is enough place.
So that landscape that is changing. Is it becoming a more expensive city for artists to work in?
It's becoming more normal.
Normal, yes. Yeah. I would.
It's not so exceptional in the beginning. No. We talk about
but
it.
We have
so
much space.
Yes.
In the city, it's too expensive. But we are in the city.
We're in the city.
Our new space is only in the city, yeah. We are in the center of Berlin.
Yeah. It used to be barren land. You could just pick a space and make a club, whatever. And for 20 years, 15 years, it was no whole meter. It was like a dark, like a dark gothic kaputte city.
But you just could now just, it's harder to find spaces, yeah. Yes. But we find it just now and have a grand opening for 3 weeks ago. And there were 1,000 people. It was very crowded.
For us.
For us.
Yeah, for a football stadium, it's not so many. Well,
I want to make a football stadium.
Yes.
With art.
Feel it.
With art. Yes, I saw one.
The next project. Yeah. Yeah, I saw a stadium too.
It's here.
Yeah.
In Cork, some football station.
Open air show.
We want to make a show there.
Yeah. I think you could do it.
Archo, but only Archo. Yeah.
What does it mean to you, Peter, to have this exhibition here, to have the work here in the Crawford, and to have so many of the artists visiting Cork, encountering this city, your gallery, and I suppose for some of them, presumably as well, maybe the first taste of Irish life?
This is part and parcel of what the Crawford Gallery is doing. It represents a contemporary strand in programming. We also have the strong historic strand in programming too, and we maintain that. But I think it's just in these times you can't really pick up a newspaper without seeing some commentary about, you know, public opinion in Germany or public opinion in Ireland or some relation to this or that. And people talk about, you know, economic life of Germany and, oh, well, you know, that, home ownership is so low there and yet so high in other countries. And yet Germany seems to be the country, you know, to which people look in terms of, trying to work out how to keep an economy going in these extraordinary times with so many challenges from China, India, other emerging economies. So, you know, the dynamics of Europe are no longer fully comprehensible to many people, nor are they deeply convinced by them. And I think that in some ways, although it was never intended, you know, when people embarked on the euro and all of that, there was a sense of optimism in Ireland. Almost nothing can go wrong. Everything else has gone right so far since 1970. That's all gone very well. How could this go wrong? So I think everybody was very surprised to see it going wrong. So these artists, in their sense of mobility and in the work that they create, which, you know, has this sophisticated but not superficial, you know, response to the economic and social conditions of today, the work ultimately has, I think, a lot to say in terms of contemporary politics and society. But it will be interesting to see what the next year's bring. And I did ask the Mike and Yup this morning, you know, I said, when the rents do go up in Berlin, and when the city really becomes, a major business and a headquarters of major companies, what will happen to the artists, you see, then? Well, he said they'll come to Ireland.
We wish. False Optimism Contemporary Art from Berlin runs at the Crawford Gallery in Cork until the 1st of June.
RTE Radio 1.
Think you know the Allianz Leagues? Think again. The Allianz Football League finals take place at Croke Park this Sunday in a doubleheader not to be missed. At 2 p.m, Derry take on Westmead in the final of Division 2. Dublin then battle it out against Tyrone in the final of Division 1 at 4. Get your tickets now for just €25 and €5 for under-16s at gaa.ie/tickets, selected SuperValu and Central Stores and usual outlets. The Allianz Leagues. Unexpect the expected.
Here at Volkswagen, we're starting a campaign to get you, the general public, to love your bank manager again. So we've decided to announce that we're offering an incredible 0% APR finance on hire purchase agreement over 3 years on any new Volkswagen. On any new Volkswagen purchase. Will someone please get that? 0% APR finance from Volkswagen Bank. What's not to love?
Volkswagen, das Auto.
Terms and conditions apply. Finance example. Polo, €14,745. Deposit of €5,781 with 36 monthly payments of €249. Volkswagen Bank Ireland is authorised by the Federal Financial Supervisory Authority in Germany and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland for conduct of business rules. Minimum deposit 10%.
If you're going to be a dancer, you never have a lot of money, Because, number one, the life is so short. You know, I mean, by the time you're 16, you must really be a fully-fledged dancer, technically strong enough to be able to go into a company. It's a long training, but a very short life. I'm one of the few people, I suppose, who really knew what they wanted to do. And I talk so much to young people, and I say, well, what are you going to do? I don't know. I don't know. I said, well, now, even if you can't be what you would like to be, what would you like to be? I don't know. So, you see, I had to pay the penalty of leaving home young, of course, but I knew what I wanted to do, and I'm very lucky.
The voice of Joan Denise Moriarty and the White Swan theme from Swan Lake there. Swan Lake will be one of the works at the heart of Cork City Ballet's 21st anniversary celebrations this November, with Lucia Licara as lead ballerina in a series of scenes from major ballets. Alan Foley, Artistic Director of Cork City Ballet. We'll hear about the November plans later, but Joan Denise Moriarty, whom we heard there, set you, I think, on the road to a life in ballet. Remind us of her enormous influence on dance in this country and tell me how you came to train with her.
She really was an iconic figure, is an iconic figure in ballet in Ireland, in the world, actually. She founded the first ballet company in Ireland, Cork Ballet Company. Now, earlier on, another Irish woman, Annette de Valois, had worked with Yeats in the Abbey and founded a ballet school. But it was actually Joan Denise Moriarty founded the Cork Ballet Company in 1945. Out of that came the Irish Theatre Ballet, which was Ireland's first professional ballet company. And out of that, of course, came the Irish National Ballet, which worked for about 20 years and had to close in 1989 when the Arts Council withdrew their funding. So essentially, she had all of those companies, plus she had her ballet school, which is where I began my training. And then I graduated into her Cork Ballet Company. And then I left her in 1989 and I continued training abroad, but I came back subsequently. But yes, essentially, it was she who was responsible for my love of ballet, and it was she who sort of instilled in me how to love the discipline behind it, because, of course, as we all know, it is a very disciplined art form.
And I think when you first went to speak to her about training with her, she might have been slightly intimidating in terms of what she said would be demanded from you as a dancer.
She frightened the life out of me. I was 13 years old and I had already written a letter to the Royal Ballet School in London asking, do they have any courses in disco dancing? You can imagine the response that I got to that. And then I went to Joan Denise Moriarty and I said, look, I think I'd like to try ballet, because I had seen the movie Flashdance. And that's when I decided, yeah, this is exactly what I want to do. And I knew that I had to go to ballet school. And I went to her and she frightened the life out of me. She said, to become a ballet dancer, you have to study art and sculpture and blah, blah, blah. And I was 13. I said, are you for real? So I legged it out the door. And I came back about a year later and I said, look, I'll stay, but on one condition, if you promise me that you will never put me in tights. And she said, of course, dear, of course. And 3 months later, she had me out in the Opera House stage in tights, and I didn't take them off for 25 years after that, which is a bit of a worry.
No avoiding the reality of dance.
Absolutely.
What was so special about her as a teacher?
I think it was her absolute love and devotion of the art form. I mean, I've worked with many teachers all over the world, you know, big sort of salubrious stars in the world of ballet. But it was she who really taught me how to love the profession and, you know, love the art form and, you know, to kind of wake up in the morning and define yourself as a dancer and bring that to the stage. And I think that's a very rare quality, and it's certainly a quality that I haven't come across that often. But it was she who taught me that.
As you said, you know, after training with her, you worked internationally. You trained in London, then went to St. Petersburg to the Kirov Ballet Summer School, which, I suppose, for you was the start of a long engagement with Russian ballet, just around the time of Glasnost, which, of course, would have been a really interesting time in the Soviet Union.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I remember on one of my trips there, we went to Moscow and to the Bolshoi, and McDonald's, they had just opened the first McDonald's. When we were there, and I'll never forget the queues around the corner and thinking, oh my God, these people are queuing for a burger and a bag of chips. But, you know, Russia at that time, initially I was in Leningrad, as it was then known as, was like going back in a time warp. I mean, you know, we used to get cabbage and frankfurters for our breakfast, and of course nobody would eat them, so they would scrape off the plates and they would make a quiche out of that for lunch. And to them this was just unbelievable. And we had a sort of a mini graduation at the end of the summer school in 89, and they told us that they had a huge surprise for us for the graduation party. So with great anticipation we all attended the party, and the huge surprise was a small bottle of Coke each. So that just gives you an indication of what you were dealing with. I mean, I went to Russia in 89, 11 stone, and I came back 9 stone. And if you think about it, I'm 6'1". So you can imagine how emaciated I was.
I know, because I actually have a few friends of mine who trained as dancers in Russia as well have stories about how harsh the regime was and how poor the food was. I mean, it very much tallies with that picture of yours.
It does indeed. And you see, when I came back, I remember I did quite a lot of interviews, and one in particular was with Tom McSweeney from RTE. And Tom was saying to me, what exactly is it that differentiates them, you know, from people in other countries? What makes them so good? And the only thing I could come up with was, in the Western world, in order to become that good, you had to give up very much. You couldn't go out clubbing. You couldn't be partying till 4 a.m. and then turn up for class with a body and mind ready to work at 10 a.m. Whereas in Russia, they actually had nothing to give up. Nothing. I mean, I remember Moriarty forbidding us from going to McDonald's, to Pizza Land, and all that, those junk food places. She used to murder us if she found us in there. And, you know, I was lucky in that I didn't smoke and I wasn't really, you know, into drink in a big way. That didn't bother me that much. But I do know other dancers found it quite difficult, you know, to sort of adhere to the strict discipline behind it. And because essentially our body is our instrument, so you have to bring that instrument to class every morning and you have to be prepared and ready to work, you know, in a way that the director or the choreographer wants you to.
And in bringing that instrument to class in Russia as you did, what effect do you think it had on you as a dancer? I mean, what difference do you think that training made to you?
Oh, an enormous difference, Vincent. I mean, it really opened my eyes to the sort of to what hardcore ballet was, if I could call it that. I was very lucky with Moriarty because of her association with all the professional companies. I was exposed to a lot of professionals. But in Russia, it's just, you know, for every single thing about the way they behaved in the theatre. Well, their approach to theatre and ballet is much more different anyway. I mean, it's considered a very high-class profession to be in Russia. And nobody bats an eyelid if anybody, you know, bloke or a, you know, says, oh, I would like to be a ballet dancer. Everybody's delighted. And back then in particular, ballet dancers were afforded very many privileges that lay people were not given, such as they were given apartments and some of them were given cars. And also remember, they were allowed to tour with the ballet company. So they were able to travel all over the world. And this was enormous. This is an enormous privilege for them because they were able to get out of Russia, if only for a short period, for a few months or a few weeks, for depending on the length of the tour, and buy products abroad that they wouldn't be able to get in Russia and bring them home to their families.
And it's even now, I suppose you mentioned the Bolshoi, and it has such cultural resonance. But then I suppose more recently there have been all these scandals and strange goings on that I suppose expose something pretty corrupt as well at the heart of that. And in a way, it's almost that might be unavoidable, given the powerful position of ballet in the society.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, ballerinas of the time back then, I mean, you must remember, you're talking about a period where there was no Facebook, no LinkedIn, no Twitter. So live theatre was essentially how people sort of went to express and feel their emotions. And so sitting through Swan Lake or Sleeping Beauty for 4 hours was a wonderful thing. Nowadays, people would not sit through, I don't think anyway, any ballet for 4 hours because their threshold and boredom is much lower. And the ballerinas at the time and the dancers, the principal dancers, were really revered. I mean, you're talking about people like Maya Plisetskaya and, you know, Anna Pavlova, the ballerina that, incidentally, the dessert Pavlova is named after. It was a French chef created it for her. But these people were superstars of their time. And, of course, they travelled the globe. But I recently read Plisetskaya's biography, and she speaks of, very candidly, I have to say, about the corruption in Russia all those years that she endured, not least the director, Grigorovich, of the Bolshoi Ballet at the time. And of course, his wife, Natalia Besmertneva, was the prima ballerina. And his sister-in-law, Natalia Besmertneva's sister, was also a leading ballerina. Now, if you look at both of those dancers today, you will see that, in fact, they don't have prima ballerina facilities, shall we say. So that again gives an idea or a perspective on what you were dealing with and the level of corruption. But, you know, most people just manage to get on with it and get over it. And I suppose nowadays, in dealing with the recent drama that's unfolding over there, it will be interesting to see how that develops.
From, you know, after your time in Russia and the training in London, then a long career in ballet at home and internationally. Over the years, Alan, what particular role would you say has meant most to you as a dancer?
The role that I always enjoyed dancing the most was the role of the lead pirate in the ballet Le Corsaire. I always loved that. Moriarty allowed me to dance that when I was 19 years old. And I danced it all throughout my career, right up to the end when I stopped dancing at 38. And I just love that. I love the freedom to express and the big jumps and the turns that were involved in the role. I also loved dancing the lead in Swan Lake, playing the prince in Swan Lake. And of course, I also loved dancing in many of the jazz ballets that we have in the repertoire of Cork City Ballet, not least Patricia Crosby's ballet Bodyguard to the music of Paul Simon, which actually is the last ballet that I ever danced in.
I suppose it's always a challenge for a dancer having to stop, as most do, as you know, as you did in mid to late 30s, and to forge a career beyond dance, often involving dance. And you've done it very, very successfully. But was that difficult to give up the thing that you so love, that you love in your body?
Well, it was particularly difficult for me, Vincent, because actually when I gave up at 38, I wasn't ready to hang up my shoes. And a lot of dancers, essentially the longevity of their career is essentially determined by genetics and, you know, what they've got from their parents, how lucky they've been with their body and how they've worked during their career, how much they've pushed it. Have they drank? Have they smoked? Have they partied all night? And because I had sort of never done any of those things, To be forced to give up, as I was at the time, I had to have heart surgery. I had to have one of my valves replaced. And then when they opened me up, they discovered that my actual aorta had dilated 78% from ballet. So I had to have an aortic graft as well. Now, the surgeon, I had the operation done in Sweden at the time, and the surgeon did say to me, you know, if you want to, you can go back to dancing. But dancing is so hard, so, so tough. I thought, if I do, I will never have what I had before. And the other thing was, towards the end, I was beginning to become a bit afraid on stage. And I had never experienced that before. I'd never experienced fear. As a result, I was able to take huge risks. And I had stopped taking risks. So I thought, you know what, maybe it is time. But certainly there was a period of about 2 to 3 years of grieving for that. But I was lucky in that regard as well, because I had made the transition as director of the ballet company. And also I'm the director of the full-time dance course at Colossus Stephen Nafa here in Cork, which is the only full-time dance course in the city and one of few in the country. So I really had sort of very gradually begun to make that transition years beforehand. So it was easier for me as opposed to somebody who just has to stop. But there's no doubt about it that, of course, it is a very difficult thing, because when you wake up in the morning, as I said earlier, you define yourself as a dancer. It's how you walk. It's how you prepare your breakfast. It's how you, you know, everything is very structured and rigid and disciplined. And then to sort of find, you know, I was on a plane. I was going to America and somebody sat next to me and they said, what do you do? And very often I used to say, I work in the theatre or whatever. And this person said, they pursued. And I said, I'm a dancer. And then I suddenly realised, actually, I'm not a dancer anymore. So that was tough.
Mm. In setting up Cork City Ballet, which you did 21 years ago, you were very young, still in your early 20s. What were your artistic ambitions with that?
I suppose in many respects I wanted to bring the Russianisms that I had learned and experienced to Ireland. And because I love the Russian system of training, I wanted to expose as many Irish people as possible I suppose, to the Russian mentality, you know, that at the end of the day, it's only dancing and it's for everyone. And to sort of remove the perceived elitism that was around ballet, that a lot of people still today believe exists. I mean, I went through many times, you know, when people say, what do you do? Oh, I'm a ballet dancer. And I could see them going, oh, lovely. And what do you do by day? And I was thinking to myself, are you nuts? Do you actually believe that I arrive at the theatre and this just happens? They didn't fully understand that actually I wake up in the morning, I go to the studio, rehearse all day, do class, do rehearsal and perform at night, that it's a profession. And like everybody else, that, you know, we have to buy a home and we have to pay the bills and we have to pay our mortgage. And it is our job to dance. That is our job. So the lawyer or the accountant or the bread maker or the milkman, they come to the theatre at night to be entertained because they've done their day's work. So they sit down, they've paid their €50, and they sit down and they say to you, now entertain me. And that's your job. So I suppose on that level, I wanted, and I still do, want to make people see that ballet is for everyone. It is accessible. It's not nothing to be afraid of. And I get the greatest kick out of seeing people who wouldn't otherwise come to the ballet come and enjoy it. For example, I have in the school, when I graduated from college, I didn't want to open my school in the city because I grew up in the countryside myself. I wanted to bring ballet to the countryside. So I opened schools in Skibbereen, Clonakilty, Bantry and Carrigaline. And one of the shows I had a number of years ago, one of the school shows, I had a phone call one night and the phone call went like this. No hello, Alan, or no how's the crack or whatever. It just went, there are no pink tights in Skibbereen. And it was from one of the parents, a frantic father who had just read the letter about his child's ballet performance the following day in the Opera House at 11 o'clock of a Saturday night. And that was his message to me. There are no pink tights to be had in Skibbereen. And of course, he'd been out milking the cows. He came in, read the letter, and I rang him back. I said, look, don't worry about it. We'll sort her out tomorrow. And to see that man the following day in the theatre with tears running down his eyes, seeing his daughter up on the stage, of course, completely transformed from what the way he had presented her at the stage door 3 hours earlier. That to me was very beautiful. And then when I see that, I think, yeah, I'm doing my job okay.
But I suppose that those possibilities of that kind of transformation are very much being challenged at the moment by the financial situation. You know, the cutbacks everywhere, and I know many dance companies are struggling.
Sure, and they are
indeed.
I'm
sure that for yourselves as well, it must be very difficult to keep everything afloat at the moment. I mean, how serious is your situation right now?
It's quite serious in that, you know, it is very difficult to keep it afloat. And ballet is a very expensive art form. That said, we're very lucky. We have a lot of sort of private sponsors, albeit small private sponsors. We're very lucky with our association with the Cork Opera House, with the Firkin Crane, where essentially that is our home where we train. The Cork City Council are very, very good to us. But we're always on the lookout for that one sponsor who will actually say, you know what, I would love to sponsor this particular production. So, for example, at the moment, we're on the lookout for a big sponsor for our production of our Ballet Spectacular Gala next November, which is celebrating our 21st year anniversary. It's happening at the Cork Opera House. And 2 weeks ago, one of the world's top five ballerinas, a woman by the name of Lucia Licara, confirmed that she's actually going to come to Cork and dance in this gala for me. So whilst the international dance community is absolutely agog that I managed to get somebody of this calibre to come to Cork, of course, now we have to try and find a way to pay her. So, yeah, the battle is ongoing.
And what about your relationship with the Arts Council? I mean, I know that you had been funded and that I suppose like a lot of companies, again, you had to actually apply through individual funding mechanisms, which I suppose are more difficult and take up a lot more time.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the Arts Council over the years, to be fair, have been very good to Cork City Ballet. That said, I mean, it hasn't been an enormous amount of money. When you think about it, I mean, the most money we ever got was 106,000. For the year. That was in 2008. Then it went down to 88. Then it went to 75. Then it went to 40. And then for a period, we were subsidised through project funding. Now, that hasn't happened for a while. But we're hopeful that, you know, we can sort of maintain our relationship with with the Arts Council and move forward. I mean, it's tough for everybody at the moment, but I think that those of us that can manage to sort of keep our head above water now in these recessionary times, be realistic, but still try and get the product up on the stage, I think they're essentially the ones that will survive. And that's one of the things that I, you know, that's actually my mantra in the ballet company and in life. I think it's really important that, you know, everyone be treated equally. And on my team, certainly that's the way it is. I don't care if you're the prima ballerina. I don't care how famous you are, what you've done, where you come from, how many accolades you have. To me, the person who makes the tea or the person who cleans the stage is as important, because everyone has their role to fill. And if you've come off stage and you've just done a big variation and you can't speak, you can't get your breath, your mouth is dry and, you know, you're dripping with sweat, the person who hands you a towel to dry your face, the person who gives you a glass of water, the person who doesn't speak to you and understands they can't speak to you because you can't answer back because you have no energy left, that is the person of the moment. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge that. And that's why I think Cork City Ballet has been so successful over the years, because I go out of my way to ensure that everyone that I work with, for the most part, sort of follows those guidelines.
Alan Foley, very good to talk to you, and we look forward to those 21 years celebrations in November.
Thank you, Vincent. Lovely to be here again.
Alan Foley, Artistic Director of Cork City Ballet there. Sarah Binchy produced tonight's programme. From all of us, good night.